Okay, guys, we're going to get cranking now. And I actually have no idea how long this is going to take. We may just fly through this really fast, or we may run out of time. I don't really have any idea. We'll just see. But we're now in Joshua chapter 5. When I originally preached through this series, this was two sermons. I did verses 1 through 12, and then I did another section, which was the end of chapter 5, the last part of it. But I'm going to combine them for Sunday school here today. Just as a kind of an introduction, we're going to revisit kind of where we've been. You know, the children of Israel are now across the Jordan. They have crossed over into the Promised Land. And the water has returned to its place. So it's sealed off behind them. No going back. And they are on the outskirts of Jericho. I mean, it doesn't say it so much like that, but they are. That's just where they crossed. They were effectively on the outskirts of Jericho. Just a little bit outside the city. And as it says in verse 1 of chapter 5, it said, as soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted, and there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. Which is exactly what Rahab told them when the spies checked out the city. So that's just a verification that that was the state of things. But then God gave Joshua another command. And this was another incredible step of faith. We sometimes tend to think of this as this was just a ceremonial thing that they did. But no, it was an incredible step of faith that he was asking Joshua to take. It says in verses 2 and 3, chapter 5, at that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel a second time. So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeath Haraloth. Now, what he basically was doing, the reason why this was a step of faith, he was basically asking him to debilitate his army. You know, right after one has been circumcised, you're not exactly at your prime for battle. And the army actually could have easily been wiped out by the Canaanites at that point in time. And Israel would know this because of what they had actually done in Genesis 34. And if y'all want to look really quickly back at Genesis 34, we don't have to read the entire story. But in Genesis 34, it talks about the story of Dinah, who was the daughter of Leah, a daughter of Jacob. When she went out to see the women of the land, and when Shechem, son of Hamor the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her and lay with her and humiliated her. And his soul was drawn to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her, which is really whacked after he had just assaulted her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, get this girl for my wife. Now Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah, but his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. The sons of Jacob had come in from the field as soon as they had heard of it, and the men were indignant and very angry because he had done an outrageous thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing must not be done. Not only had he assaulted her, but he was one of the unbelievers. You know, he was not a believer in God. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him to be his wife. Make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. You shall dwell with us, and the land shall be open to you. Dwell and trade in it and get property in it. Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Ask me for as great a bride price and gift as you will, and I will give you whatever you say to me. Only give me the young woman to be my wife. Now, the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father Hamor deceitfully, because he had defiled their sister Dinah. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to a one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we agree with you, that you will become as we are, by every male among you being circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to ourselves, and we will dwell with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and we will be gone." Well, they did that, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. That was verse 24. "And on the third day, when they were sore, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and came against the city while it felt secure and killed all the males." So there. "They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went away. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because they had defiled their sister." So not only did they kill them all, they robbed them. They took their flocks, their herds, their donkeys, and whatever was in the city and in the field, and all their wealth, all their little ones, and their wives, all that was in their houses, and they captured and plundered. They wreaked havoc. "And then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, 'You have brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household.' But they said, 'Should he treat our sister like a prostitute?'" So they were not repentant. So this is the story that is in their own family history that they're going to know and they're going to remember. So this was an incredible act of faith on the part of the children of Israel to go through with this. But they obeyed. Joshua obeyed, and he had all the people obey. And it appears that there was no argument about it, at least none recorded in Scripture. So, why did God command him to do that? Besides just a step of faith, why did he do that, and why then? You know, he could have done that on the other side of the river, but he chose to do it after they had crossed over into the Promised Land. One reason is that God gets the glory for protecting the Israelites and not themselves. You have to see in verse 1 of chapter 5. If you look at that a little bit more closely, when it says, "As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over," it says, "their hearts melted and there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel." It's weird. They weren't fearing God. They were still fearing the people. And God wanted that glory, so he was continuing to try and reinforce that. In fact, you know, if you look back to when Rahab shielded the spies. No worries.
What's up?
Before she left, right?
I know.
So we can all stare at her.
Yeah,
phones on silent.
Phones
on silent. I can embarrass and say, "Give me your phone."
Yeah.
Look here. Have that class.
I need to turn mine off.
Yeah. But if you remember when the spies came back and they reported to Joshua, it said the hearts of them were melted because of us. See, they're still thinking about it to a degree about themselves. And God is wanting to reinforce that he is the one who gets the glory for protecting the Israelites and not themselves. And also, another reason why that needed to happen was that the children of Israel in the desert had been in a state of judgment and disobedience. If you look at verses 4 through 7, it explains this a little bit. It says, "And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them, all the males of the people who came out of Egypt, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. Though all the people who came out had been circumcised, yet all the people who were born on the way in the wilderness after they had come out of Egypt had not been circumcised. For the people of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, the men of war who came out of Egypt, perished. Because they did not obey the voice of the Lord. The Lord swore to them that he would not let them see the land that the Lord had sworn to their fathers, to give to us a land flowing with milk and honey. So it was their children whom he raised up in their place that Joshua circumcised, for they were uncircumcised. I know because it said in verse 2, make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel a second time. It was different people, not same guys twice. For they were uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way. So it was, in a sense, a sign that they were cut off as a people from the blessings of the promised land, even though they remained under his providential care and provision while they were in the desert, in the wilderness. And they remained in that state until the disobedient generation had died off. So until they were all gone, they wandered. And until the new generation had been given the outward sign of God's promises, they weren't ready to take the land. They weren't ready. So I guess if you want to use kind of a really rough parallel or illustration of it, before, if you think about, say, a military action, unless they were spies, it was a covert thing, they had to have a uniform that identified who they were with, what side they were on, you know, which flag were they flying under. Well, the circumcision was a rough parallel, like a soldier needing to put on the uniform of the country he represents before going into battle. It was another permanent memorial of God's covenant promises, and more than that, it was a sign and a seal of that. It was a sign of it, and it was a seal of it. It was a seal of God's promise. It was a signification that even though one generation disobeyed and did not share in the blessing promised, the next generation would. God's plans are not going to be thwarted, and his promises remain. Now, we have to understand that when it comes to circumcision, it's also the same as baptism. Of course, it's a parallel, but there's an outward aspect to it, and there's an inward aspect to it. Now, we know that just because one was circumcised, they were also part of that disobedient generation that died in the wilderness. God's covenant promises remained true, but those covenant promises also brought judgment because of their disobedience. Well, so there is an outward aspect to circumcision, and there was an inward aspect to circumcision, as it is in baptism. The outward aspect was it marked a Jew as a Jew, as part of the descendants of Israel, and as part of the people of God. That's what the outward aspect of circumcision was. But there was an inward aspect to it, was that it was a reminder that Abraham believed God and his covenant promises, and that it was accounted to him for righteousness. God desired both aspects. The children of Israel who died in the desert had the outward aspect, but they had uncircumcised hearts. The children who crossed the Jordan had faith and believed God, which is pretty awesome when you think about it. The cowards raised the brave ones. We tend to think the other way around, like, oh, our fathers were so brave and we're such wimps. Now, I've seen some of that going on right now with Dunkirk, the movie coming out. You know, there are a lot of people who are of later generations, like mine or even younger, and they just think these were young men. These were young people, many of them. Not only that, some of the older guys that came across on the boats to help save them were people who had been through World War I and hated war, hated it, yet they did what they had to do. The character that they showed, in general, obviously there were a few that might have panicked and freaked out, but generally speaking, there was an extraordinary amount of courage and fortitude that they were shown. And I know that Stephen Ambrose, when he's written on World War II, and he's taught, when he taught classes before he died, that was one of the things that the students just marveled about, was the people who did these extraordinary things were our age. Many of them were like college student age or even high school senior age. And they were doing extraordinary things under incredible pressure. And how could we do something like that? That's what they're asking those questions. We tend to think in that direction, like the generation of courage. But in this situation, the cowards raised the people who would take the land, which is really interesting. So, after they had healed under his protection, God declared their reproach rolled away. And as it says in verse 9, and the Lord said to Joshua, today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. It didn't just say he removed it, it said he rolled it away. Possible meaning of that is when he says the reproach of Egypt. The denigrations of Egypt on the Israelites from afar because they had wandered into the desert and God had not yet brought them into the promised land after 40 years. There was probably a little bit of ridicule going on. Other people have also considered it because of the reproach of the disobedient generation that preceded them in the long wandering had now died out. The word Gilgal, as it says, so the name of that place is called Gilgal to this day. It is similar to a Hebrew word that in verb form means to roll, and as a noun it means wheel. So both of them have that symbolism of rolling away of reproach by God. There are some commentators that even go to talk about that the general healing time after circumcision might be 3 days, and the rolling away means the rolling away of the stone after 3 days covering the grave. That gets a little speculative in my view. That's a little stretching it, but, you know. That's just me. But then it says in verse 10, while the people of Israel were encamped at Gilgal, they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month in the evening on the plains of Jericho. And that was a party. It was. And in the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. And the manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land. And there was no longer manna for the people of Israel, but they ate the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. So redemption was only complete once they had entered into the land of promise. That's when it was effectively completed. If you want to look at the passages that talk about that a little bit, a summary of that is in Deuteronomy 9, 25 through 28, or if you want to look at the actual incident in detail, you can go in Numbers 14. It's a lot longer passage. But that scorn was removed as the promise was fulfilled. Even though God said he forgave them and showed mercy on them, there was a scorn that still remained. There was a punishment that still remained. And that was removed as the promise was fulfilled. And it says they celebrated the Passover from the produce of the land and the manna ceased. Now, God's provision did not stop. It just came in a different form. It wasn't as flashy, but it was still his provision. It was from the fruit of the land that he had promised. And Peter Lighthart has written about this, and he said, this whole feast was a display of audacious faith. This is another area where we're talking about. We don't want to just look at it from a ceremonial standpoint. We have to look at the significance of where they did it, when they did it, and all that. Not only placing yourself in what appeared to be utter danger of annihilation through the whole circumcision thing, in that same place, you're literally just not far from the gates of Jericho. You're in the same hood. But you start eating up the food in a land you haven't even conquered yet. So before the conquest of Canaan had even commenced, they acted as if it was already finished. That shows some of the faith that was involved there. Now, a couple of applications from that part of the passage. First of all, this passage screams for us to walk in faith and obedience, even when outward circumstances seem to point to something else. You know, the outward circumstances were going to be, okay, we've crossed over, we got to make hay first. The last thing we want to do is place ourselves at further risk in the promised land by going through all this mass circumcision, and then just kind of having a picnic, having a feast out there right outside the gates of the city from their own stuff. But that's what God commanded them to do, and he commanded them to do it in faith, and they did. They obeyed. But in our day, as in many other eras of history, but comfort, expediency, and pragmatism are the marks of the modern church, by and large. In culture, in politics, and in lifestyle. You know, we're selling out as fast as we can at extraordinary speed. So why are we surprised that God does not bless when we are not obedient at all costs? And I don't mean, you know, like in the time of Jeremiah, we're supposed to pray for the prosperity of the land that you're in, you know, and just be faithful and just do your business. But 2 Chronicles 16:9 says, "For the eyes of the Lord search to and fro over the earth to show himself strong for those whose hearts are completely his." Or another way of translating it is, whose hearts are perfect towards him. Focus solely on God. And then secondly, we see the sacraments as warfare. And I remember the first time I ever heard this was when Benjamin was being baptized, my fifth. You know, we were getting at that family size where we were getting kind of weird looks a bit, you know. And I remember the guy who was baptizing Benjamin, said, you know, and we had the whole family up there at that time, you know, they were all up standing up there, looking the way a whole bunch of little kids just kind of look. Standing there. Anyway, I remember Rob saying, you know, this may really seem strange to some of y'all, all these little children so close together and baptizing a fifth. Said, but you know what? Said, they're raising up an army. They're raising up an army. You know? And that made me feel pretty cool. Yeah. So the sacraments are warfare. You know, when we baptize a baby, it's a shot over the bow of the enemy. Now, you know, we are still called to raise that child in faith and to look in faith to Christ and trust in him. And we don't just trust in water, we trust in him and his grace and his mercy. And when we observe the Lord's table, that is warfare. That is warfare. Because we are declaring our trust in him and our walk with him when the world is going crazy outside. We're saying we declare where we stand, and we stand with Christ. And that he stands with us. But God would have no part of the children of Israel going into battle without the circumcision and the feast. They would have been considered unprepared without it. That was part of their preparation. Worldly wisdom would have seen this as both dangerous and foolish. And we need to view baptism and the Lord's Supper in the same way, as an act of warfare. And we need to seek not only to observe these things, but to have circumcised hearts. Circumcised hearts. By the way, before we move into the next section, are there any comments or thoughts about that part of the chapter?
You know, the older generation did not go into the land. They saw how fruitful it was, but they had no faith in God to bring them in the land and give them victory. And so God left them in the wilderness to wander for 40 years. He did provide for them.
Yeah.
During that period, he was still gracious, but they did not go in. But you know, this and it when the spies, of course, spoke with Rahab. That was before they crossed the Jordan and God had parted the waters.
Mm-hmm.
But she said, you know, we, all the way back to when you crossed the Red Sea, we knew God had given you the land.
So they've been dreading it for 40 years.
Yeah. And now, this new generation, God gave them this new sign of, because the older generation saw the parting of the Red Sea, and the new generation saw the parting of the Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
And God was ready to bless if they just stepped out in faith.
That's right. That's awesome. Now, as we move into verse 13, through 15, it says, when Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said, are you for us or for our adversaries? And he said, no, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped, and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. Now, there is more of that interaction with the commander of the army of the Lord at the beginning of chapter 6, but we're going to talk about that in the next week. In this short passage, we see that Joshua is doing his duty. Now, it could be one of two different things, or both. He could be praying and meditating. That's entirely possible. Had his head down. Or he was reconnoitering the land and the path that they were going to be taking to attack. Doing some reconnaissance, which is also probable. But he had his head down, checking out the path before him, as he should. And as just kind of an observation, God's presence can be expected when we are simply doing our duty. It does not have to be a special event, right? You know, we have a tendency to look for a special service or a special event or some special thing that we're doing. God can show himself to us, can, you know, manifest his wisdom to us, his exhortation to us, his conviction of us, all these things, when we're just doing our duty, which means making sales calls or cutting your grass, changing a diaper, disciplining your children, praising your children, whatever it is you're doing, he can show himself to you. He can manifest things about himself to you, even in the simple things of just doing your duty. Well, Joshua looks up and he encounters a theophany, a pre-incarnate Christ. His sword is drawn. Now, why would we refer to this as the pre-incarnate Christ, as a manifestation? Why would we do that? Why would we say that? Why is it not just an angel?
Joshua worshiping.
Exactly. You don't worship an angel. The angel, if he had bowed down to worship and the angel said, no, don't do that, you know, you would have known it was just an angel. This was pre-incarnate Christ. He was encountering God. His sword was drawn. So Joshua thinks, okay, this is either a friend or foe, and I've got to find out which one it is. Is this somebody who's coming along to help us out, or someone who's on our side, or is this somebody coming from Jericho that I need to whack? You know? So Joshua asks a simple question. Are you for us or for our adversaries? He asked a simple question and he got a simple answer. No. God does not fit Joshua's categories. Peter did not fit his categories. He didn't say, oh, I'm for you. He didn't say that. He said, I am the commander of the Lord's army. So Joshua falls down and worships as he realizes who is standing in front of him. Now, I think in this situation, Joshua showed the quality of his leadership. And the reason I'm saying that is because the best leaders know when to lead, and they know when to obey. They know when to take charge, and then they know when to get down on their face. And that showed the quality of Joshua's leadership. He immediately places himself in a subservient position and asks for orders. He asks for orders. So, what was his first order to Joshua? It's in 15. He said, "Take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy." So his order to Joshua was, worship me. That was his order. And as we will see in the next chapter, worship will be the essence of his command for Joshua to give all the people. Because the entire conquest of Jericho was an act of worship. It was an act of worship. We understand that the destruction of the city, they were not supposed to take anything for themselves, was because Jericho, and we'll talk about it more next week, is that Jericho was a first fruits offering of the promised land. That was the first fruits offering. It was dedicated to God. All the other cities that were to come, there were things that they could take and that they could do. But Jericho was not. It was a consecrated, set-aside city. Sacrifice. And also, we will also see that the going around of the city for 6 days until the seventh day also has a certain amount of significance as well. That likely the conquest of the city was on a Sabbath, which is also interesting. But another couple of applications is, first of all, as we do any of these narrative stories, we have a tendency to want to insert ourselves in the story. You know, like, dare to be a Daniel, you want to be Daniel, you know, those kind of things. We want to insert ourselves in the story, and what we typically do is we insert ourselves in the most favorable place that we can, right? We're on the winning side, as it were. But we need to understand because even though we, like them, are God's covenant people, so it would be easy to put ourselves in that situation. But we have to see that God's business here was moving his program forward by using sinful Israel as his tool for exercising judgment against Canaan. If you look at Deuteronomy chapter 9, see, it wasn't merely a fulfilling of promise to the people of Israel, it was also exercising judgment against Canaan. Deuteronomy 9, 4 through 6. "Do not say in your heart, after the Lord your God has thrust them out before you, do not say, 'It is because of my righteousness that the Lord has brought me in to possess this land,' whereas it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is driving them out before you. Not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart are you going in to possess their land, but because of the wickedness of these nations, the Lord your God is driving them out before you, and that he may confirm the word that the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Know therefore that the Lord your God is not giving you," said it three times, "he's not giving you this land to possess because of your righteousness, for you are a stubborn people." Okay? So he is about his program of bringing judgment onto the ungodly nations, and then to say, "I am good to my promise that I made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." But we are just as likely to be in the position of the people being smacked down by God for our iniquity by another not very righteous people. I think we've seen that even in our day to day. God's plan is not about perpetuating or forbearing with our sinful ways, but about perpetuating his holiness and righteousness. That is what sanctification is all about. God often smacks us down to sanctify us. So, we need to be careful that we don't insert ourselves on the winning team thinking it's because we deserve it. We are in a war just as Joshua was. And there are no neutral positions. Even though it was not a bad question for Joshua to ask any normal man, he wasn't encountering a normal man. So we are called often to take sides. We must understand that every area of our lives, in this light in the context of war. Now, I'm not saying we have to just walk around looking for fights. You know, we are to seek peace and live in peace and that kind of thing. But when we are called to make difficult decisions that have ethical implications, that have gospel implications, we must stand. We are called to take a side. You're called to take a side. When we confess our faith at the end of the worship services, what we are doing is drawing a line in the sand between us and the unbelieving world. That's what we do. We're not just saying it to each other. We're saying it to the world. And we stand with those who have stood before us when we do that. We have to be concerned more with whether we are on God's side than whether He is on ours. That's the question we need to be asking. Are we walking in obedience to His command, or whether He's jumping on our boat? Because that's not going to happen. God is not a partisan. He is a sovereign. He does not take sides. He is the side. Does that make sense? He doesn't take a side because He is one of the sides. We have to decide whether we're on His side or not. He has only one true goal, which is His glory. All the things that He does, the mercy He shows, or the judgment that He inflicts, the power that He displays, the forgiveness that He offers, those goals, those actions are all part of the goal of His glory. And we tend to think that our prayers or our petitions and our issues are somehow distractions to God, that He has to take a break from His real work to take care of these things, you know? Like this morning when I'm trying to get ready, and of course I'm not thinking of us as dogs or anything like that, but you know, every time I'm trying to sit down and do one more review of my sermon or the Sunday school lesson, my dog Lucy needs something that I'm having to get up and do, and no one else was up yet. So I had to feed her. Oh, her water was almost out. Oh, she had to go to the bathroom. Oh, she needed to come back in. And oh, she needed to be pet a little bit. You know, it was just one thing after another after another. That was a distraction to me. Well, the things that we come to God for are not distractions to Him. He doesn't have that kind of limitation. This is the way we tend to view not only taking care of the dog, but it can, things like changing a diaper or fixing broken things or disciplining a child are distracting us off the real stuff we're supposed to be doing. But those are all part of God's plan for us. The things that we do are all part of God's plan. And therefore, when God listens to our prayers, hears our petitions, and deals with our sin in our hearts, that is core to His seeking His own glory. That's all part of that for Him. And we must also see that in this case, His glory was going to be manifested in His fighting the battle for the children of Israel. And we'll see that next week a lot more. Because what He made happen, there was no way they could make happen. There was no way they could make that happen. And we'll talk about that more next week. Are there any other thoughts or questions? Comments, observations? Okay then. Barry, could you close this, please, sir?
This day to come to the subside of some of your house to worship. study and learn and thank for the preparation that Jay has done and the others that take opportunity to teach and help us to dig into the truths of your word. Father, we just pray that in all of our lives that we'll humble ourselves before you and seek your face in everything that we do, and that we won't allow the material things and other things that can distract us from that, God. We just pray that you'll continue to bring whatever necessary our way so that we turn from those things and from sin in our lives, and that we seek on your face and that we seek on your glory. Thank you again for this day and opportunity to worship. In Christ's name I pray.
Amen. Thank you all.